If you've got a Bible with you, you'll want to open it to Ecclesiastes chapter 10. We got halfway through that passage last week. We're going to finish up our study of Ecclesiastes tonight. We'll be picking up here with verse 8. And we're in the middle of a series of Proverbs. That's kind of where we left off last time. That sort of echo the Proverbs of the book of Proverbs. So they're very similar to that. The professor is kind of talking about the contrast between wisdom and foolishness, a lot like what we saw in the book of Proverbs. And so Ecclesiastes chapter 10, starting in verse 8, it says, "He who digs a pit will fall into it, and a serpent will bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stones is hurt by them, and he who splits logs is endangered by them. If the iron is blunt and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength, but wisdom helps one to succeed. If the serpent bites before it's charmed, there's no advantage to the charmer." All right. Here the professor is describing, you know, and we've talked about the professor. We're talking about Solomon. We believe that Solomon is the writer, the Kohath, the teacher, the instructor. He's describing here a series of unfortunate events that seem pretty much to be accidental in nature. A lot of times people will look at this and see the words, "he who digs a pit," and we immediately want to assume that we're talking about somebody who's doing that out of malice, somebody who's digging a pit as a trap for somebody else. But there's really nothing in the rest of the context that would suggest that. Most scholars don't believe that's what he's talking about. Just talking about in a broken world, you can be going along doing the stuff that you normally do. It could be your job. You know, you're out digging holes or, dig wells or cisterns or whatever. I mean, you could be doing this and still end up falling into the thing, end up having an accident. You could be doing some demolition job on some house. You pull down a wall and suddenly get bitten by a snake who's made its nest in there. All kinds of different things that go on. You're endangered by the wood that you're splitting. Something could come back up and whack you in the head. You're endangered by the stones you quarry. Just the normal events of life, the basic things that we do end up being things that can end up hurting us or harming us in some way. That's just the nature of life under the sun is what he's indicating in this. That just stupid stuff happens in this broken world. And his point is, since the world is oftentimes this hostile, then we need to employ as much common sense as we can in this. He makes that statement about if the edge is blunt, you're going to work twice as hard. You're going to end up having a stroke because you're trying to cut wood with a dull axe. Just employ a little common sense, a little wisdom, work a little smarter, and you can get these things done. We can avoid a lot of trouble through the use of common sense. And you know, that's not a wrong thing to encourage common sense. We don't ever want to make the mistake of thinking, well, I'm going to trust God in all things, and that means I just kind of float through life and I never learn anything or I never do anything to advance my understanding of the world that I'm in. That's a terrible fallacy to fall into. We, of course, want to prioritize common sense. I remember I used to have this car. I don't know if I told you guys this story or not. I can't even believe I would ever tell this in public, but I'm telling it anyway. I used to have this. Riley had given me a Toyota. Riley always gave me his old cars when they were dying, and that's just where I was in life. I was in my early 20s or whatever, and this is a little blue Toyota that he had, and he gave it to me, and it was falling apart anyway. And one day I was starting to get out of the car, and the front door, the driver's side door, wasn't opening, and I couldn't get it to open. And I'm shoving at it and pounding at it, and I thought, oh, crud, there we go. Now the front door is broken. The driver's side's broken. So I had to climb out across the street, across there and get out of the passenger side door. And this went on for a couple of weeks. I was crawling across there and getting into the passenger side. And then one day, the passenger side was closed, and all of a sudden, it was broken. All of a sudden, I couldn't get out of that. I thought, here I am. I'm stuck in this car. I'm going to find a skeleton in here. And I just happened, as I was rattling at it, I just happened to look down and realized, oh, I accidentally locked the door. And I did that, and all of a sudden, I stopped. And I looked over at the driver's side door. And I unlocked it. And I opened it up. A little common sense, see? If instead of assuming or we're going to the worst possible conclusion, a little common sense can save us a lot of problems or troubles. It's a broken world. Things do go bad, but if we employ some of the God-given and common sense that we have, we can kind of avoid stupid stories like those. Verse 11 in there, it's kind of difficult to translate. The thing about charming a snake, translations like the NASB and the ESV, as I'm reading from, link it with verses 8 and 10 as a caution about using wisdom. You know, if you don't get the snake charmed in time, it's going to bite you, and it didn't do you any good to try to do it. Charming snakes, really? Well, I don't know. I mean, that's just what it says. I there's nothing really necessarily contextually for us to understand what it's trying to say in that. I'm not a language scholar, so I really don't know. The other way that it's translated in like the NIV, or I think it's that way even in the King James, is a serpent may bite when it's not charmed, but the babbler is no different. And either way, it makes sense. You know, use caution, and common sense is one side of it. The other side of it is too much talking is as deadly as a serpent. It's sound advice. In fact, it actually does lead into the next verses quite naturally. Verse 12, the words of a wise man's mouth win him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness, like Charlie Sheen. A fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be, and who can tell him what will be after him? The toil of a fool wearies him, for he doesn't know the way to the city. Okay, again, this is very much like the Proverbs that we read before. You know, fools talk too much is what he's saying. They go on and on about stuff that they really don't know. They don't really even know what they're talking about. I know a lot of preachers like that, but that's just, you know, that's one of the characteristics of that. Making lofty arguments about things that there's absolutely no way to prove. There's no way to know these things. And we remember that when we talk about the idea of the fool, we're talking about someone who is, no, it's not somebody who's necessarily mentally deficient. We're talking about somebody who is living in ways that are contrary to God's intended purpose for us, that are counter to the kind of good life that God intended for us, the wholesome life that he desires. And verse 15 adds that laziness is also a characteristic of this bad behavior, using the excuse, you know, I'm not going to go to work. I don't even know the way to town. I don't know how to get there. I'm just going to lay around here. And, of course, we covered this kind of concept a lot in the book of Proverbs. Verse 16, woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of the nobility and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. Through sloth the roof sinks in, and through indolence the house leaks. Now here's Solomon. You know, Solomon was just a child when he took the throne in Israel. So, you know, he can't necessarily be just talking about age, but we know that one of the first things that he did was to cry out to God for wisdom, and God granted him that. And so he's warning about immaturity in leadership, making sure that those who are in a position of leadership or power aren't people that are immature and don't know how to handle themselves or don't have a good grasp of who they are. The New Testament kind of echoes this a little bit when it talks about making sure that we don't put people who are novices within the Christian community into positions of leadership, because the temptation could be there to be seduced by pride. So what he's talking about here, what Solomon's talking about, is how immature leadership can lead to the deterioration of a country. And he uses this picture of a house with the roof sinking in and you know, the falling into disrepair. The same thing would happen to the infrastructure of a nation if their leadership is only interested in serving self. So leaders that understand their responsibility, they're not just simply using their power to try to gratify their own desires or lusts. They're using the power that they have sufficiently and in a way that's going to actually stabilize the country. Verse 19, bread is made for laughter and wine gladdens life, and money answers everything. Even in your thoughts, don't curse the king, nor in your bedroom curse the rich, for a bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature tell the matter. Verse 19 is said to be the voice of the self-indulgent king, talking about, you know, bread for laughter, wine gladding, money answering everything. And it's hard to say, since we do have to remember, this is the professor's view of life under the sun. So he's looking at life from the perspective of this fallen world, from the perspective of you know, if this is all there is, then these are the values that seem to be the most important. In a very practical sense, I mean, just from a life under the sun perspective, these statements actually make sense. You know, to eat a good meal certainly can make a person feel happy, feel good at the moment. One of the happy times that you can get together with people is to be able to share a meal together. Oftentimes when, people are going out on a date, one of the things that they want to do is eat a meal together. That's that same concept. That's what drives people even into addictive behaviors, where they're trying to recreate that sense of pleasure that comes from that by eating, escaping through it like a drug addict would do. Talks about wine lifting the spirits, and of course it'll do that temporarily. A guy goes into the bar, he's throwing a few drinks back, and all of a sudden he's happy as can be. He's singing along with the jukebox. Everybody's friend, unless he's a mean drunk, and that's another story altogether. And if a person has the right amount of money, these are the things that he's saying. If a person has the right amount of money, I mean, it certainly does seem to open a lot of doors, get a lot of things done under the sun. If you got all kinds of cash, this seems like there's a lot of things that you can buy or buy your way out of. People have committed crimes and been able to buy their way out of it through lawyers, things like that. But none of these things that he's talking about speak to the fulfillment of life, to the sense of true wholeness. Those things are still completely elusive, even from the professor's perspective on that. Those are elusive to life under the sun. Sure, you can achieve these things. You can find these temporal pleasures, these immediate gratifications of the pleasures from the various aspects of life, but they're never going to fulfill. They're never going to satisfy. And he finishes warning that even if we don't like our rulers or leaders, the best course of action is not to speak against them. He even uses hyperbole. Don't even think bad thoughts about them, because birds will come and you know, whatever that's, you know, he's it sounds like a Disney cartoon by the end of it. You got birds sneaking around telling secrets, but he's using hyperbole to try to explain that it's, you know, that these the words have a way of finding. I mean, really, this is actually a good rule of thumb to use in terms of how we're going to speak about people or even think about people, because what we think has a way of finding enunciation oftentimes in our expressions and in what it is that we say. And words just have a way of finding their way out and finding their way around. And, you know, I'm sure all of us here have some experience where we've regretted saying something that we've said. So it's a, you know, words are powerful, and we've certainly talked about that before. We want to be careful how we use them. We want to harness those things, that gift that God's given us, so that we're using it in a way that edifies and builds up and strengthens, doesn't tear down and ruin things. Okay, we move on to chapter 11. For some reason, I've got chapter 9 written here, but it's chapter 11. Verse 1, cast your bread upon the waters, for you find it after many days. Give a portion to 7 or even 8, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. Now, the phrase of verse 1 is probably very familiar, I'm sure. Have you ever heard it? Have you heard that phrase, cast your bread upon the water and it'll return to you? It's actually a tricky sort of thing to translate. There's a lot of different points of view in terms of what it is that this is actually trying to express. The three main views, and they're differing main views as to what this is actually saying, is first, they're saying that it refers to shipping commerce, that you put your grains and stuff onto boats, cast them out on the water, send them out to far different places, and the return is substantial. You've increased the amount of commercial strength through that reward, for that investment. There's a great reward for that investment. Secondly, it's taken with verse 2 to refer to spreading out financial investments in multiple directions, in as many ways as you can, and in many diversified ways that you can, and you can get the most the greatest possible return for the increased amount. Neither one of those really grabbed me very much, but that's just me, maybe because, you know, it's just me. But if you go to the earliest Jewish and Christian rabbinical and early church father teachings concerning this verse, they had a different take on it. They saw it as a metaphor for giving to the poor, doing something that seems like it's wasteful. You cast your bread on the water, that seems like a wasteful thing to do, but the idea is that it has returns that we're not expecting, that we wouldn't expect returns in ways that might be helpful if we encounter trouble. And you put that together then with verse 2. And, you know, you don't know what disaster may await you on this earth. We talked about that with the on a Sunday when the parable of the unjust steward. That was his thinking. I'm going to ease the burdens of people around me, and that will come back to me in ways that will keep me from being in need when I'm out of a job. The message reads it, be generous, invest in acts of charity. Charity yields high returns. Don't hoard your goods, spread them around. Be a blessing to others. This could be your last night. Well, that seems reasonable. And I kind of think that that's the idea behind that. It seems as though it would be reasonable to me, but you think about it and decide what seems best. Verse 3, if the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. If a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. There it is. He who observed the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. As you don't know the way the Spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with a child, so you don't know the work of God who makes everything. In the morning, sow your seed, and at evening, withhold not your hand, for you don't know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. All right, he's pointing out that in this world, in this life, there are a lot of observable causes and effects. Cause and effect, that's really basically the core of scientific research and determination. You look at the cause and the effect of things, and we catalog those things and we observe them and remember them. And there's a lot of things that we're able to look at and see. He talks about the clouds, you know, get filled with, you know, we know that a low pressure system comes around. It's usually going to result in thunderstorms and rain. We know that if a tree falls down, whether in the forest, whether anybody's here or not, it more than likely will make a sound, existentialist arguments aside. And when it lays on the ground, it's not going to move on its own. It's not going to get up and go somewhere else. We know that it's, you know, inertia has completed and it's not going to do anything else. It's not going to get up and dance. Those are things that we know. But the problem is that even though there's all these observable things, all these things that we can recognize, link together as cause and effect, which help us to get a better understanding of the world that we're in, and even more so now in the world that we live in, there's still an awful lot of mystery. There's still so much that's mysterious to us, so much that we don't understand at all. And the problem with that is that we could become so intrigued. We could be so enamored with the idea of trying to figure out cause and effect. We could constantly be observing and looking at, and it's almost like a little bit of humor here, that we could lose our sense of productivity. In other words, a person's so intent on looking at the clouds, wondering if it's favorable for rain to plant crops, or examining the winds and wondering if they're coming from the right direction, then he never ends up doing anything. He's so busy trying to chart all this stuff that he never gets around to planting any crops, and so he's never growing anything. And I realize that this is not the passage's original intent, but as I was thinking about that today, I was thinking about how Jesus in Matthew's gospel, when he told the story, the parable of the sower, and how he gave us the responsibility of making sure that we were throwing seeds around. And that's one of the things that we talked about even then, that we don't want to get so caught up in looking at all the various programs that are available or the different ways in which we should be doing these kinds of things. You know, Jesus said to chuck seeds of the gospel around in life indiscriminately, wherever we are, whenever we can, and leave the rest up to him. But if we get so preoccupied with making sure we got the right program or watching people to make sure that there are signs of receptivity or figuring out whether they're going to, you know, respond to this favorably or not, that we could end up never sharing anything anyway. We're just so caught up and so concerned about making sure we're doing it the right way or not offending anybody or doing anything like that, that we never plant any seeds of the gospel. And, you know, flinging seeds, that's all we're responsible for as Christians. That's, you know, doing the good that God's called us to do, representing his love in this earth, sharing with people the source of our hope that we believe in Christ. You know, in this context, the professor's pointing out that there's so much that we don't know. You know, we can sit there and try to observe all this stuff and get this thing down to an exact science, not only just in sharing the gospel, but I mean in life. You can sit around and just think that we've got to get this so exact and so perfect, and you know, there's so much that's completely out of our grasp to ever know. We don't know how in the world the human spirit enters a person's life when that consciousness and that unique personality is there and present. We don't know when that actually begins or how that arrives or what the process of that is. And I realize we can say, oh, well, there's, you know, it's all encoded in the DNA, but there's so much that DNA can show and so much that it can't. I mean, the DNA is not going to indicate to us a person's desires or love. Is DNA going to tell us what kind of hopes or dreams this individual has? Where do these come from? And there's so much that's mysterious about that. How does that get passed from person to person? How does this human race continue to grow and go on and on? There's so much that's mysterious stuff that we've just got to leave with God. Things that are beyond our ability to grasp. Like, you know, there's a lot of things. God does his thing. That's even true when you think in terms of the context in which he's talking about, planting seeds and stuff. There's so much. Once, you know, we have to do our stuff that we're responsible for. That's planting the seeds. The farmer has to go and plant the seeds. And you know, and if you spiritualize that, putting in the context of sharing the goodness of Christ, that's our responsibility. That's what we've been, the task we've been given to do, is to fling seeds around indiscriminately, to love indiscriminately, and then we leave that with God, because once a seed is put in the ground, it's beyond our jurisdiction. Nobody's going to go out there and make it grow a little bit faster or anything beyond that. That's the, you know, that's God's stuff at that point, how that thing responds. And it's true with the gospel. Once we've planted that seed, once we've shared that love, then it's beyond our jurisdiction. Then we have to leave that in God's hands. Okay, well, enough of me stretching those scriptures to make that point. Let's move on. Verse 7. Light is sweet, and it's pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth. And let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body. For youth and the dawn of life are vanity, are smoke, are vapor. Again, the professor's kind of bringing us back to this refrain that he's come to several times now in the idea of enjoying the life that we have in front of us, that we need to enjoy it while we're living it. Embrace the whatever youth or stage of life that we're in as we're moving through on this journey. And it's interesting, this idea of removing vexation. What he's saying in that, in essence, is even, you know, whatever the circumstances are, even if we are in situations where there is pain or discomfort, don't dwell on that, is what he's getting at when he's saying remove vexation and the pain. Don't let that become our identity. And there's a real temptation to do that. When we get into really tough times in life, when we face difficult things, either things that we experience ourselves or you know, physical ailments or whatever it is, the tendency for us as human beings is to begin fixating on that and becoming that, becoming whatever that is, letting that thing begin to dominate our identities and dictate to us who we are. And there's a sense in which the professor is trying to warn us about that. Don't do that. Don't allow that to happen. Remove that. Enjoy the life that you're able to enjoy. Look actively for the things that are a blessing in life and enjoy those. Take a hold of those and receive those as gifts from God. And you know, if we've got that breath to breathe today, if we've got that shelter over us, if we've got this sense of community that we can draw from, then that's a wonderful thing. Let's rejoice in that and find wholeness in that and stability in that and make the most of it. But then he warns, you know, when we talk about making the most of life, he says there in verse 9, you know, walk in the ways of your heart in the sight of your eyes, but know for all these things God will bring you to judgment. He's not trying to say, you know, God's going to get you in the end somehow, but he's saying that even though we're going to enjoy this life, we're going to live it for what, you know, for the most that we can, making the most out of life, we keep in mind that God is waiting for us on the other side of this, that there will be a reckoning on all of these things. So we don't want to just live with abandon. That's what he's doing. He's putting a qualifier in there. Enjoy your youth, but remember that there's something going on here. There's a bigger picture that's unfolding as this story of your life unfolds. And on the other side of this life, Well, there's God that we're going to meet up with. And that actually leads us right on into to chapter 12 and verse 1. He says, "Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, 'I have no pleasure in them.'" So as we're there in the professor's study, we've been listening to him talk. We've been intrigued with all the different parables that he's told, all the different proverbs that he's expressed. We've seen him guide us through all these different images. He's walked us through funerals. He's taken us out to various places in life where we've witnessed things and tried to understand them from his perspective. We've gone from funerals to parties and back again. And as we're looking at the professor there in this study, all of a sudden we realize he's actually a lot older than we first understood him to be. And as he's standing there, he's looking at a framed picture of himself on the wall when he was a young man in the prime of his life. And he's flashing this really white smile in the picture. And as he's looking at it, he's tracing the outline of his face. And we notice that his hand is filled and lined with veins, and there are age spots on it, and his fingers tremble just slightly as we're observing him. And he slumps down into his chair, and he says to us, in essence, precisely because life is fading away, because life is so short, we need to remember, that is, we need to honor God. Because getting old sucks, is what he's saying in this. And we need him at that stage of life. We need God more than ever at that stage of life. So we need to develop a pattern that is leading us from youth to old age where we're walking with God. That's why it's important. That's why we don't ever want to fall into the trap. As a young person, you don't want to fall into the trap of thinking, well, you know, this is something that I'm going to get around to when I'm older and I've done having all the fun that I want to have. I know that those were precisely my thoughts. I grew up in a Christian home. My dad was a pastor. I was a preacher, and I lived in a Christian environment. And at the time, I remember as a young person thinking, "Well, that's their thing, and I'm not going to worry about that right now. I'm going to have the fun that I want to have, and then maybe when I'm old, later on down in life, then I'll get around to serving God or committing my life or my heart to Him." The problem with that kind of thinking is the patterns of life. And that's what he's trying to get across here, that we develop patterns in life. We develop patterns in the way that we live and the expectations that we have. Patterns that actually really begin to set as time goes on. And the older we get, it doesn't get easier to suddenly turn around and come to God. It actually becomes that much more difficult because the hardened rivets in the road that we've, the rivulets in the road that we've dug there through our repeated pattern of choosing a certain way. And so this is what the professor is warning us, that when we get to that stage in life, when we're older and we're really, really dependent on him in ways that are very obvious. I mean, we're always dependent on him, but it becomes so much more obvious as we get older. In those moments, we need to be a person who's developed those patterns of walking with him, of looking to him, of leaning on him, of knowing what it is to trust him, so that it doesn't become this kind of terror at the end. And that's what he's talking about. When he's describing this as evil days, he's not trying to say, you know, some people have tried to read into this apocalyptic concepts, and that's not it at all, not contextually. He's talking about the unpleasantness of getting old and dying. It's just no fun. I'm going to be turning 50 soon, and it's alarming to me that this is happening to me. And I note the changes already that are taking place in me. I mean, things that, I don't know what it is. It's harder to surf all of a sudden. It's not, you know, and I know that there's guys that are out there doing it and they're just better than me, but it's one of those things that I'm noticing in my own body that are changing, that it's not pleasant. It's not something that I'm really excited about and happy about. Oh, this is awesome. My knees hurt all the time. This is great. My dad lived to the age of 94, real, just almost to 94. He's right there. And, you know, it was interesting. He was 60 years old when I was born. So I only knew him as this old dude. I never had any, apart from old photographs, any image of him in his prime as a person not affected by age. But I do remember that, you know, he told me one time very earnestly, he gave me this advice. He said, don't live as long as I did because it's terrible. And I think that's good advice. But it's not easy. It's not in the sense of the things that we have to face. It's not that pleasant. And that's what the professor is doing here. He lights his pipe again and he's talking to us about this and he's reciting in essence a poem that starts with verse 2 to describe how unpleasant, how strange, how foreign it feels to us to experience this aging process. Verse 2, he says, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. And we're going to break this down as we go because there's all this imagery in here. And this is a reference. This is metaphor. This is poetic license that he's using here to describe what happens here. And he's talking about the lights, both the greater and the lesser lights beginning to fade. That spark, that edge that we had begins to dampen down, begins to get a little bit darker. Things are growing dim as we get older. Verse 3, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they're few and those who look through the windows are dimmed. You see the imagery. You feel what it is that he's talking about. The body begins to tremble and decay. You can even picture like an old house that's beginning to dilapidate. Trembling, he describes it, trembling like the servants in the house bent over and they're no longer standing bolt upright and facing life like they did before. There's a weight, there's a heaviness to the thing. The grinders, you know, he's talking clearly of making a reference here to the teeth. What teeth are left? Those grinders that are left are still not operating that well. It's not strong enough to bite down hard on anything. You're putting the apples aside and eating applesauce more often, and mashed potatoes and pills are your favorite meal. And he talks about the windows, the eyes dim, you know, those that peer through the what's that? You're glad you came? Yeah, it's awesome, isn't it? I'm here to cheer you up. He talks about the windows dimming down. You're losing your eyesight. Everything's beginning. You know, I know that feeling lately. That's been more and more increasing. Verse 4, and the doors on the street are shut when the sound of the grinding is low and one rises up the sound of a bird or hears the sound of the bird, is it's kind of nebulous in the Hebrew there, and all the daughters of song are brought low. And here again we get this imagery, and this one to me carries the most pathos in it, because now the door is shut. The door to the street is shut. The idea behind that of that mobility that we once had in youth, that ability to go where we wanted, do what we wanted to do, all of a sudden that's barred to us. We can't do that like we did when we were younger. We can't go out and do what we wanted to do. So that means that everything starts kind of grinding to a halt. And little by little, all the sounds of the activity of life begins to slowly begin to wind down. I know that in my own life, when my kids were young and Robbie and I were young and the house was just full of noise and activity and yelling and screaming and dishes and all these different things. And then, you know, you pass into different phases where suddenly that's not the case anymore. There's not as much noise. Things begin to wind down, grinding to a halt, bringing their conclusion. Our voices, when it's talking about the birds, rising to the sound of birds, because of the English translation, some have made that out to be like, you know, older people tend to get up early in the morning, but I don't think that that's what the idea behind it is. Many Hebrew scholars point out that it's more in reference to the sound that's being made, so that it's making that correlation between the voice. Like the voice begins to go to this kind of weak bird-like sound, as opposed to that strong, robust voice that we had in our youth. Now all of a sudden, our voices are more like birds as we're trying to speak. And the song, when he talks about the song, you know, the song is reduced to a whisper. You can't even belt that tune out anymore that you used to be able to in life. Verse 5, they're afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. This increase of things that become frightening because of one's own instability. When we get older, we're not as inclined to race up the top of a ladder anymore. In fact, even just little obstacles in the way become big issues, big deals that we have to navigate become scary to us because of our own sense of instability as things begin to widen down. The almond tree blossoms, he said, and you get the imagery there, right? What are we talking about there? Yeah, the white hair, the gray hair all of a sudden begins to blossom out like flowers on the head. The grasshopper drags itself along, where once we were bouncing along through life, doing all these different things, all of a sudden now, like, and even the imagery there, and I know that I've seen this in storybooks somewhere, of pictures of grasshoppers as old people that are kind of hunched over. It carries with it that certain artistic sense in that, of being bent over, of dragging along, just a shadow of what it used to be able to do. And desire fails, we can figure that one out, because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. Now, this is really interesting, because most commentators are very astute to point out the curious phrasing here when he says, going to your eternal home. That is a very unusual statement to be made in the Old Testament. You know, we've talked about that before. In the Old Testament, there was not a very clear picture of an afterlife, of anything like that. And basically, through all of Ecclesiastes, we've never had a very good, clear view of any sort of afterlife. But here, we've got this. He's not calling it the grave. He's not calling it Sheol, which would have been the normal phrasing of this. We're going to the grave. We're going to that, you know, that place where we're going to be staying, but literally the way he's wording this, we're going to our forever shelter, and the connotation of shelter is completely different from the idea of the grave. The connotation of shelter is actually is far more hopeful in its representation. You almost sense, and many commentators point this out, that you get this glimmer of a hope of something more beyond just the experiences there, a hope beyond the vanity of this place. Verse 6, before the silver cord is snapped, you know, we move from this old age and all the debilitations of this to this final phrasing, before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. All is vanity. All right, here the professor is describing the irreversible finality of death, which life under the sun certainly gives us no indication to see otherwise. Life under the sun, life from a natural perspective, if this is all there is. And what this uncomfortable old age is leading towards is this final, this ending point. And he uses three metaphors to describe it here. The silver cord snapped, the golden bowl broken. Most scholars link those together, saying that this is the picture of a lamp hanging from a cord. If that cord is cut, the lamp falls and it shatters, it breaks, and its light goes out, which carries with it the allusion to the idea that, you know, something tethers us to this life, to this life experience that we have right now, this plane of existence that we have right now here in this room. When that breaks away, then that's irreversible. That's done. The light goes out. It's never coming back in life under the sun as we know it. The pitcher breaking, like the idea again of this fragile old person, the idea of the pitcher being dropped suddenly by a fountain where it's been drawing water all this time, slips from the hand, breaks on the side of the fountain and shatters. It's broken. It's irreversible, irreparably broken. Or the wheel, which is the pulley that is lowering a bucket or, you know, some sort of drawing device for, you know, a container down into a well, into a dug well, that breaks off and it falls down into the well, into that, it's swallowed up. The idea that it's just taken and swallowed up by the earth and it doesn't return. But again, Solomon doesn't leave it with just this. I mean, you know, obviously, yeah, it's depressing. It's not a cheery concept. But if Ecclesiastes is anything, it's extremely honest. You don't usually come to a church meeting and have everybody stand around and talk to you about death this much. But it's an honest reality check. This is life, and this is where life is going. And it's interesting that he describes it here. He describes the body returning to the dust, but the spirit returning to God who gave it, which is a fascinating thing. Again, showing an insight there that supersedes what most of the Old Testament ever declared. And it's not necessarily presenting us some sort of, you know, exact theology on an afterlife, but it is suggesting the possibility of an afterlife from Solomon's perspective, which is huge. That's profound. And what it does then is it punctuates the lesson of verse 1 in chapter 12. Because of this, because this is where this is going, it's very important for us to remember God. It's very important for us to have a life that's founded in and built on this relationship with God, this connection to God, this desire to embody what it is that He is all about. And that's why it's important to remember our Creator, because we're going to meet with Him again, is the idea. The body goes to the dust, the earth from which it was created, the spirit, this energy of life, this expression, this personality, everything about us that makes us the unique individual we are, that was so clearly created, is going to walk through the veil of this existence and meet face to face with the one who made us. And that's an important thing to keep in mind as we live this life. At that point, at our exit from this strange journey of life, we're going to realize at that point, and this is what the teacher's been leading us to, at that point, we're going to realize the vanity of life under the sun. We're going to see it as clearly as ever. We're going to realize that it was smoke. Everything that we were trying to make happen here, all of those different things that we thought were going to make us fulfilled, all those different dreams and goals that we had to try to achieve power or get our way, all of it's going to evaporate like smoke in the presence of the one who made us. When we step beyond this existence here, we'll realize just how tenuous, how vapid this plane has really been in comparison to meeting up with the God who made us. This is going to be like a vapor. And verse 8 then brings into focus all the different times that the professor has used this phrase of vanity. It's vanity. This is why he's using this phrase. Life under the sun is temporal. It's smoke. It's passing. But we're all going to be confronted with someone beyond this realm, beyond this material world, and that's what really matters. That's why it's so important for us to understand that there's more to this life than just what we touch and taste and feel and see. There's so much more to this life than what's observed under the sun. And so then the professor gives his final conclusions here. Verse 9, besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They're given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. So the professor is explaining that all of this that he's been doing here, all of his life spent teaching, was for the purpose of presenting a truth that a person can live by. Words, he says, that are like goads and nails. That is, words that press the will forward towards what's right, and nails like are like hooks that we can hang our worldview on. Things that give us a basis and a grounding for the worldview that we embrace. And he credits God as the source of all of this wisdom. He says, given by one shepherd. And if, you know, you'll see that the translators believe that, because most in most translations, I noticed that shepherd is capitalized. And that's what he's trying to say, is that God has provided us a revelation by which we can base our life and our life choices on that are going to lead us to this proper conclusion. Fix ourselves on those. Everything else is debatable. Everything else is up for grabs. But this is the stuff that we want to focus on and find our identity in. And then he this is amazing to me that this was written 2,000 years ago, or, well, no, more than that, thousands of years ago. And it's still so true today that, you know, there's so much to read. There's so many books out there. There's so many things out there that vie for our attention. It'll make your head spin when you think about all the things that, you know, in my life, all the things that I haven't yet read that I want to get around to reading. The most important book that we can study, the most important book that we can focus on is the one given to us by the shepherd. Those words are words that provide life for us. So the professor in his study there closes all the books that are on his desk, and he turns the lamp out on the side of the desk, and he stands up and indicates that it's time for us to go, and he leads us to the door that we came in through, which leads out into the hallway from where we came. Verse 13, the end of the matter. All has been heard. Or in other words, this is the conclusion of the whole thing. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Bad translation as far as I'm concerned. Duty is not in there at all in the Hebrew. And what he's saying in that is this is the essence of man. This is what it is to be human, to really, truly be the human being you were meant to be. Verse 14, for God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Life is mysterious. It's full of unanswered questions for us. If Ecclesiastes does anything, it gives us permission to not understand, to be confused at times and to be perplexed, to be hurt and unhappy at times because of the way this world is. But it also encourages us to find joy in happiness, and happiness in what it is that we have right here, the gifts that God has given us right now, to enjoy the wonder of life no matter what we understand, because it all springs from this as the basis of our existence, that we honor and acknowledge God, and we're living life the way he intended for us to live it. We're moving back into original vocation. When we look at what seems like the futility of life, we can face that all the time. We're faced with things that are big, too big for us to understand. We want to just slump to the wall and wonder what does it mean? Why am I even here? Why am I going through this? So we need to, in those moments, remember the professor. Remember him smiling. Remember him smoking his pipe. We remember that we're here to reflect the reality of God. That is the summation of what it is to be a human being. We're here to reflect the reality of God, that he's there, that he's good, that he loves us, and he is love. No matter, if we make that the goal of our life, that my life's goal, my reason for being is to reflect the reality of God, then no matter what circumstances we're going through, everything takes on a different hue. Everything comes to a different color. Futility suddenly leads to a sense of purpose. The things that seem so random and meaningless suddenly take on a sense of form and are woven into this tapestry. Things that seem like smoke and vapor suddenly solidify into a cross. It's meaningful, it's purposeful when we understand our purpose, our meaning and our reason for being, to reflect the reality of God in this world, our original vocation as humans. That's the ultimate in wise decisions to make, is what he's concluding there, because one day everything is going to be out in the open. One day every one of us gives an account for what it is that we've done here, what it is that we've done with this gift of life we've been given. And so the professor clears his throat and he closes the door without even saying goodnight to us. And we're standing out in the hall, looking around at each other, feeling like we just woke up from a dream. And we turn around and we walk down the narrow hall that has uncomfortably low ceilings and all the angles are off. We look back over our shoulder, wondering what that was all about. And we head back out into the hallway, where all the doors are much larger and the hall is better lit, and All the doors are leading out to stories about chosen people and prophets and kings and poets. And we'll meet back up in that hall in September when we gather back together again to go back through those doors and explore more of what the Old Testament is saying to us. But as you remember, we're taking a break for the summer from this. So September 7th, to be exact, is when we're going to come back here and pick up our Old Testament studies on Wednesdays. Now, I want to remind you that we're going to have a couple different meetings, July 6th and August 10th.